General Burke's reel 4. So we've reached the assembly area.
From Havering Corps Wood, we did reconnaissances about a day and a half to a village called Traco, which was a short distance out of Havering Corps Wood, strangely untouched. There'd be no war down there at all. As far as I remember, there were still some inhabitants of the village. And they gave us the sight of German lines, which was very interesting. But there was one thing made one think twice. There was it looked like a black wall. The trenches, the positions were about 800 yards apart. There was a black wall about 400 yards out. And there was this colossal barbed wire that the Germans had put up. We stayed down there in our bivouacs by the tanks, getting them ready. There was one interesting incident. Nobody was allowed to assemble more than 10 people at a time. And there was a table was set up quite near us. Wonder what on earth was happening. And it was the brigade padre, Talbot. He was afterwards Bishop of South Africa, I think, Bishop of Johannesburg. He started communion, and he ran the whole day with people of 10. It was quite astonishing, the people who took communion throughout the day. That was a digression. That night, we moved up into our assembly position, which had been taped. It's the first time I'd seen tape used for force tanks. The white tape took us up to Traco, and then they put off spurs of white tape for individual tanks. We had a halt in the village in the middle of the night for some soup and rum, and we got into our positions quite early, the engine ticking over, and we started off at 6:15. And it was a most astonishing business, because there was dead silence, and there was no machine gun fire, anything like that. It might have been London fog, till 6:15 a solitary gun went, and then the whole world lit up. And it was Crystal Palace, but it was Crystal Palace on the German lines. And I remember it so well. It was the most sustaining thing that's happened in the war. See, the Germans were getting it, not us. And we went on down to the first line, which was a grand ravine, which was, everybody thought it was going to be an obstacle. We hadn't got air photography as developed as we have now, and we had to have a halt there for 40 minutes in order to not to run into our own barrage. Of course, it turned out to be quite a trickle of water, not a position at all. And the Germans all packed up for breakfast in some of the dugouts, and the rest of the Germans were sent sort of running back. And that halt had the most profound effect on Tenerife and my company, because it enabled the Germans, just gave them 40 minutes to pull themselves together. We went on after that, having collected my crew, who'd all got out for a smoke. We went up under Flake here, and there we prowled up and down the wood. The infantry being left behind, they hadn't come on. I think they were astonished. It was a 40-minute halt that did it. By that time, I was getting short of petrol, and I'd been hit by a splash in the back, and I had six crew hit altogether. And so I started to go back, and I ran into the first time I'd seen the commanding officer sometime, Colonel Kingdon, and he told me to go back to Traco. We went back to Traco, and that was the end of Combray. Machine gun fire, this armor-piercing stuff from the Germans was so intense that my front visor was cut half in half. It was hanging like that. Machine gun was all sprayed and completely out of action, and the unditching beam had been screwed down sideways. But we'd already used our fascine. That was on this black barbed wire with the Hindenburg line. And that machine worked extremely well. We dropped him plumb in the middle and climbed out over him.
Did you find the cooperation between infantry and tanks during Cambrai satisfactory?
Well, as far as I can say, it was non-existent. It was all right up to the Grand Ravine. And after that, they didn't seem to come on at all. I don't think they thought they'd get beyond the Grand Ravine. They wouldn't admit that, of course.
Just one final question that I wanted to ask you. Well, two, actually. First was, what was morale like in the tank corps after Cambrai?
Tremendous. It was tremendous. Throughout the corps, we thought we'd established ourselves, which was something. And, of course, we held everybody else in wholesome contempt. One did. There's an indication that in the hospital train going back, we had a sister in charge of everything, and she told us that the bells of London had been rung for our victory. And, you know, the whole thing sort of went up in the air. It was terrific.
Yeah, I can imagine. And the final question, you've mentioned Fuller already. I wondered whether you came into contact sufficiently with him to be able to form any impressions on what kind of fellow he was.
No, he was a G1, you see, of the tank establishment. And I was a second lieutenant, and one held them in wholesome contempt, a whole lot, but one did, you see. Well, it's the same now. The only chap we had any touch with was a fellow called Hotneck.
Yes.
We met him, he came and saw us off at Traco. He was a good chap.
What was Fuller's reputation like within the Corps at that time?
Well, God, he was a sort of God the Son, really. You see, God the Father was there. And Fuller was the next thing. Well, there's very little contact in those days between. There's much more contact now between the staff and the others, but none then at all.
Yes. Good. You were telling me, I remember, that before you went into the army, you had originally planned a career in medicine. I wonder at what stage and for what reasons you changed your mind and decided on a career in the army.
Well, I hadn't got a London matriculation. I was working for that, which was the first thing. And it's difficult at that time to throw back to the general opinion in London and England too, that everyone had to go to war. War was essential, and to be left out was just unthinkable. It was an entire reverse to the present situation. And of course, one just wanted to get into the army, and that's really the real reason.
But after the war was over, when you could have reverted to your pre-war ambitions of a medical career.
Yes, but it lost 4 years.
Yes.
And it seemed a big gap, and I'd got to know the army. And I just was waiting really for a regular commission. And while I waited for it, I got engaged, and I put in for the Indian police. And I sat for the civil service examination for it. And I was offered a vacancy in the UP, in India. But meanwhile, an offer of a regular commission came along, so I took maintain the status quo, as it were.
Why were you attracted to a military career immediately after the war?
I don't know.
Would you have
medicine is fascinating. It's a very attractive subject. There's no ulterior motive about it at all. I didn't want to kill or cure anybody.
When you decided on a military career, were you particularly concerned to continue to be involved with tanks?
Oh, yes.
Or would you have found a military career in another regiment?
No, I don't think I would. I was just wedded to tanks. I think we all were in those days. Also, we were pioneers, and if one's a pioneer, one has some a certain amount of attraction. No, I wouldn't. If I hadn't have got a regular commission well, of course, it's not exactly factual, because there was no commissioning into tanks in at all. They didn't exist. You got a commission into a regiment and you seconded to tanks. I was commissioned in the Worcestershire regiment and seconded to tanks. So I just stayed there. And then, of course, when the tank corps came along, it remained permanent, and when they made the Royal Tank Corps, which was about 1925, something like that, we were transferred wholesale from our original infantry regiments.
In initially taking a commission into the Worcesters, was there not the real danger that you might not have been involved with tanks?
Well, I suppose one could, but the only thing that happened, I did get a letter from them saying that it was a £5 joining fee. It was a subscription for something or other. And of course, I wore the regimental badges of the Worcestershire Regiment.
I see. Now, I want to talk to you about Bovington in some detail, but before we go on to that, one incident you mentioned, which I'd like to get out of the way first, is this business of training White Russians on tanks at Bovington. When did that occur?
That must have occurred early in 1919.
And what happened exactly?
Well, we woke up one morning and found that a squad of strangers had been posted to Bovington for training, and they were Kerensky people. They were all big chaps. They had their officers, especially selected, and they were magnificent. They produced their own ideas of soldiering, which of course attracted the camp very much. And they came up in the morning and they paraded. I remember it so well. They paraded in a little parade ground by their headquarters in two lines. And their colonel came on parade and they broke into a song, which was interpreted as, "Good morning, my children, I hope you've slept well and had a good breakfast." And they wrote, "Yes, my colonel, we're ready for work." And then they marched off to the left, down to the tank park, singing as they went, quite cheerfully. And they were allotted to crews. They did most of their work, they got a certain amount of mechanical experience, they did most of their work in driving and running tanks themselves. They were never an infernal nuisance in tank park. I was an instructor then, but every time a senior Russian officer came near them, they switched off the tank, got up and lined up, and did this chanting again. And of course, it's a waste of time, and of course, they couldn't get the tank started again. On Fridays, they used to go down for pay. They used to march through the camp to a sort of rather somber tune, rather like the Volga boat song, and got their money and came back 20 minutes later to a sort of light foxtrot. They were there, as far as I remember, about 6 weeks. They had an enormous guest night when they went. And of course the G battalion they were attached to thought they'd make all the Russians drunk, of course, and it was the other way around. They showed them all up. It was a frightful night. But they were very popular. They went back to... they disappeared from us. We didn't know what happened, but we did hear indirectly sometime afterwards most of them being killed.
Did they prove to be good students?
They were frightfully enthusiastic. Frightfully. They were rather sort of a sledgehammer type. The thing didn't go in and they gave it a smart knock with whatever they'd got. But they were good students. Very, very keen indeed.
What level of competence were you able to bring them up to in training as compared with British recruits?
Second-class crash driver.
What does that mean exactly?
Well, you get the thing going and you go straight, and if you change down, it doesn't go down, you just push it until it does go down.
I see.
But it's a little-known episode. Nobody knows anything about the White Russians, but they were there, and they were very popular.
Now, in 1919, by which time you had convalesced from injury, you had had an administrative job at Bovington for a period of about a year. In this period, around 1919, what were your expectations that the Tank Corps would continue as an independent entity?
There's a good deal of hesitancy about it, because the rest of the army were plumb against tanks, and it was, I would say, our expectation was precarious. And we were cut down from, we had 19 battalions when the war finished, and we were cut down to about 2 by 1919. The second and third and the fourth were formed at Wareham, down to 3 battalions. So it was as bad as that.
Can you give me any specific examples of the reasons why you felt a certain precariousness about the future? I mean, in what sort of ways did it show itself?
It's very difficult to answer that. There was a lot of coming and going, particularly amongst officers, which always upsets things. Officers coming in and officers being returned to unit or clearing up because they didn't like it. That caused a certain amount of change, which is always a bad thing. And then, of course, the accommodation was non-existent. We hadn't got any battalion barracks like another regiment, anything like that. Tanks, they're very short of tanks, and they only had the Mark V, had no new tanks or anything like that. But it was good, the spirit was good, but I can't think everybody would put any money on the thing being stabilised.
Were there at this time any formed opinions about the possible future for tanks, other than its continuation as an independent arm?
Well, one was a very junior officer in those days. One didn't really think very much of it. One thought much more of the sporting side. And of course, games and so on and so forth were of tremendous importance in those days. But we worked hard. Really training men too, because the men had gone out mostly. It's a little difficult to give you a decent answer.
Let me press you a little on this point. You have said there was this feeling of uncertainty about the future, this feeling of precariousness. Now, apart from the continuation of the Tank Corps as an independent arm, were there any other possibilities that seemed feasible for the future of tanks at the time? I mean, were, for example, people talking about, oh, well, tanks are likely to be absorbed by the infantry or absorbed by the cavalry or whatever?
The cavalry certainly never came into it, not at this stage at all. The absorption... Well, the 3rd Battalion was formed by the complete transfer of the 1st Machine Gun Battalion, which it decided to disband. That brought in sort of a strange new element. But the... Actually, looking back, it's so difficult. Well, I don't think there was any separate thing at all. We were very much separate entities. You see, the 3rd Battalion were at Lydd, and although they were Tank Corps in name, there was nothing to do with the Tank Corps. The 2nd moved up to Farnborough, and they were a self-contained entity. Matter of fact, they had trouble over posting of officers, the second did, because the officers objected to being posted to India because they said they belonged to the second tanks. And Huelis had to go down, and there was a general post all round, because pointing out that they were a corps and they were liable to posting to other units. The 5th were Perim down, moved up there. They were quite separate too. One met them, they knew one or two in them, but they were quite separate battalions. I think that's very likely applicable, the result of the infantry influence, because the infantry battalions were very much their own body. The first battalion of a regiment was quite separate to the second. And I think that came about with the tanks. The only sort of intricated part were the schools and the depot. They were at Bovington, and they were very much...
It sounds more as if there was just a general feeling of uncertainty about the future, rather than any particularly developed views on what would happen to tanks. Would that be a reasonable assessment?
I think
assessment?
That is so. It was...
No one knew.
No one knew. And he had a very small representation at the War Office, and they sort of never told one anything.
Mm. Of course, what often happens when one doesn't know is to fill the vacuum in one's lack of knowledge. Rumours propagate. I just wondered if there were...
I think you've hit the nail on the head. It was lack of knowledge and the uncertainty. Because the future of the tank corps or regiment as a whole didn't really become firmly established till 1925, 1926. And then it was quite definite.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's move on then. I'd like to concentrate first on the 3 years between 1919 and 1922. Now, in the autumn of 22, the tank corps was finally established in a permanent form, and in 1923 the tank corps became the Royal Tank Corps. But before it was formally established, I'm very interested to know what kind of things were going on at Bovington. In the first place, could you tell me, in those early years, from 1919 onwards, up to 22-23, what was the tank corps establishment at Bovington in terms of equipment and men?
We'd had a brigade headquarters as a sort of top business, and as a second, it had the depot battalion, which was the first depot, had the schools, the driving and maintenance schools, and had the 4th Battalion forming. They were at Wareham because there was no room at Bovington, but they were forming there. That's really what it consisted of. And of course they had workshops, which was quite a formidable proposition. There were quite a number there.
And during this period, 1919 to 1923, was the manpower at the Tank Corps Centre at Bovington, where you were, was the manpower fluctuating, or was it fairly fixed and static during that period?
Well, it fluctuated to a certain extent. The driving and maintenance schools, their establishment and the workshops, they had a peace establishment, really, and they were firm. And the instructors were appointed for 3 years to the driving and maintenance school. So that was quite a firm entity. The depot, they had their cadre, which formed their headquarters. They had a lieutenant colonel commanding, and second in command, and company commanders, and so on. But the officers were very coming and going, because they came there before they were posted to regular battalions, and a lot of them came there to do their courses, and some of them didn't stay. They fluctuated a lot. The other part which was fairly firm were the Lulworth schools, the gunnery school. That had a firm establishment and it had a proper commanding officer and so on.
So all of the instructing side was fairly permanent?
That I think was established.
Yes. Now the recruits themselves that you were, or the trainees, shall we call them, that you were receiving between 1919 and 1923, what kind of people were coming into the Corps at that time for training?
Officers or men?
Officers.
Well, officers, we're a thorough mixed bunch. Some of them were coming for promotion. Some came because they thought it was something new. And a whole lot of them came because they weren't wanted with their regiments. We had quite a lot of them. And we got a reputation of having the best men, the worst officers in the army. And it was a lot in it. Quite a lot in it.
Now, the first post-war commanding officer at the Tank Corps Centre at Bovington was Hugh Ellis. Could you tell me a bit about the kind of influence he brought to bear at Bovington?
Hugh Ellis was a law unto himself because his name, very difficult to describe exactly what his influence was. It was all-absorbing. Everybody swore by him. The men liked him, knew him well. He was the father, really the father of the Tank Corps, because he made his reputation through going into action at Cambrai. And when he came to Bovington, they all knew him. He was known, as I say, he was a father figure. Little disappointing later on because he got lazy and, of course, he went to the War Office. But he was the first commandant. Mm. He lived down at Morton with Lady Ellis. I knew them personally. In fact, I stayed with them before I got married.
Mm. What sort of fellow was he? How would you describe
him? Great
sense
of humour, very quiet, and rather like all sappers. Queer in some ways. His dress was quite fantastic. He didn't have a regulation jacket at all. He had a sort of bastard affair, rather like the Australians, with a button at the cuff and so on. And his hat, too. He generally had a couple of fishing flies in it. He was quite a unique character.
I didn't realise he was so unorthodox.
Oh, yeah, he was frightfully unorthodox.
Can you give me any stories to illustrate that?
Well, they had one of the first sort of outside sporting events was a boxing tournament they had at Bovington. And Hugh Ellis said he'd give the prizes away because everybody put on a blues or a dinner jacket. And Hugh Ellis turned up, no pair of grey trousers and his fishing hat with flies on it and sat there giving away the prizes. That sort of startled everybody. He was like that.
Apart from Ellis, during this period, 1919 to 23, who were the leading figures at Bovington?
Well, they had people who'd had brigades, tank brigades in France. They wanted to keep the commandant of schools was a colonel called H.K. Woods. He'd had the 2nd Tank Brigade in France. He was a figure. His second-in-command, Carter, was a well-known man. He'd taken the first armoured cars over the Rhine at the end of the war. The commandant of the depot was an infantryman, but he became very tanky in the end. Hope. Very well-known. He was 60th Rifles.
Would you single any of these people out as being particularly influential on Bovington during those years?
Carter was, from the training point of view.
Why was that?
Well, he had ideas. He was the first one to really get down to the intercommunication between tanks. You had a flag system. It was very elementary, but it was the start of intercommunication between tanks. Then the gunnery, they had Broad was a gunner, and he came and took it over, and.